You probably heard his name the first time when he made history.
A teenager is headed to Queen's Park, but this is no class trip.
Even if you don't really remember that now.
19-year-old Sam Osterhoff coming out on top for the Progressive Conservatives in tonight's by-election in the riding of Niagara West Glanbrook. He becomes the youngest member of provincial parliament in Ontario history.
A 2017 by-election brought Sam Osterhoff to the Ontario legislature and to national attention when he was just a baby-faced teen. But if you heard anything from him in the months that followed that, it was probably nothing more than a missed vote or a cringeworthy viral video.
We stop the carbon tax.
We stop the tax.
We stop the carbon tax.
We stop the tax.
You'll keep more of your cash.
We stop the tax.
We're open for business, so relax.
Recently, though, working under a far more socially conservative government, Osterhoff has been a lot more outspoken. He's 21 now, and he's not afraid to stand with pro-life advocates on the lawn of Queen's Park, to push hard for a repeal of Ontario's liberal sex ed curriculum, or even to quote everyone's favorite children's author.
Quote Dr. Seuss, a person's a person, no matter how small. I've always said I'm pro-life. I will always speak for children who are too young to speak for themselves, who have no voice.
Oh, and last week, some seniors showed up at his constituency office to read, and the police were called. You might have heard about that, too. Since he has become perhaps the most visibly fundamentalist elected politician in the country, we thought today it was time to ask, who is Sam Osterhoff? Where did he come from? How did he manage to get himself elected when he was a freshman at university? Where did he acquire these hardline views at such a young age? And what's next for him? Where does he see this story going? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Grant LaFleche is an investigative reporter with the St. Catharines Standard. He's been covering Sam Osterhoff since he was a non-elected teenager. Hey, Grant.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for taking the time. Do you remember the first time you heard of Sam Osterhoff?
Oh, yeah. So you got to go back a couple of years to when the provincial Tories were gearing up for not the last provincial election, but the one before. And what was then called the riding of Niagara West Glanbrook was an open riding for the Tories. They didn't have a candidate because, as you may recall, Tim Hudak, who was the party leader, had stepped away from politics after having been defeated twice in his bid to become premier. And there were a bunch of candidates who wanted to stand for the party in that riding, but there were three that stuck out. There was Rick Dykstra, which you know now has problems of his own. There was a guy named Tony Quirk, who was regional councillor in Grimsby here in Niagara, who would later get embroiled in a very long and complicated political controversy here in the region. And then there was Sam Osterhoff. Nobody took him seriously at the time. He was this 19-year-old, just turned 19, former junior aide in Ottawa to a conservative MP. And he was running to stand as the candidate. He was a freshman at Brock University. Nobody took this guy seriously. I thought, oh, he's just a kid who's politically interested, you know, maybe belongs to the young Tories or something at school. And he ended up on the strength of mobilizing, and this speaks to a great deal of where he comes from politically. He was very good at mobilizing the church community in what now is called Niagara West Riding. And on the strength of that, beat both Rick Dykstra, who was supposed to be the favorite, and Tony Quirk, who was an established politician.
When you first met him, what struck you about him? Where does he come from? What kind of kid was he then?
Well, the first time I met him was over the phone, so I hadn't seen him face to face. I was working the weekend shift. The nominations for the party in that riding had been decided. And lo and behold, he wins on the Saturday evening. So the next morning, I'm rounding up the candidates. I talked to Dykstra, I talked to Quirk, and then, of course, I need to talk to the winner, who was Sam Osterhoff. And it was remarkable because you have to remember, at the age of 19, if he went on, which he would later do, to actually win a seat in a by-election, he'd become the youngest MPP in Ontario history, which was sort of this historic-making thing that looked like it may well be a likelihood. So I called his home that afternoon, the Sunday afternoon, looking to get comment, talk to him about his win, what his plans would be for the by-election, so on and so forth. And I was told he could not come to the phone because it was the Sabbath and he does not work on a Sunday. So we actually didn't get a chance to speak to him for some weeks after that. He did not do media interviews. He was sort of surrounded by, I described it once as he was perpetually surrounded in fog. The assumption was, which has, you know, turned out now to be correct, that because of his fundamentalist Christian background and the fact that he was homeschooled, he's very conservative and very religious on many social issues, but he wasn't discussing those publicly. And then after the by-election, he still was not really talking to the press. He certainly wasn't talking to us, and we're the paper of record for the Niagara region. And I think the first time you actually get any sort of substantive interview from him is right after the by-election, when he gets swarmed by a scrum of reporters at Queen's Park. And he didn't want to answer questions because he had to plan it. Oh, he didn't show up for a question period for his first question period because he was planning a party because he had got elected. He was absent for votes on social issues. Remember, the Tories were in opposition at this time. So it was very strange. He was this very inaccessible figure, despite his historic making win, probably for about a year after he took to office.
What did you learn about him, both after, I guess, he won the nomination and during the campaign and afterwards, about his background, where he comes from, what makes him tick? What was being said about him, either in the church community or elsewhere in the region?
The initial kind of, you know, scuttlebutt on Sam Oosterhoff, in most circles outside of his own riding and kind of his own religious community, wasn't particularly flattering. He was referred to as a fundamentalist in the pejorative sense, right? And once you dig into it a little bit and you actually get a chance to talk to him and you look into how he operated when he was seeking the nomination for the party, you actually learn quite a bit about who he is and how he thinks politically, how he thinks tactically. He's a young man. He was homeschooled, if you want to get into kind of his more personal background. So he didn't go to public school. He didn't go to private school. He was homeschooled, which is not uncommon among some very strict fundamentalist Christian homes. He enrolled in Brock University when he was 18, but he's never finished. He apparently is taking some of his courses part-time now. He was enrolled to take political science. When he was 16 or 17, he got involved with the federal conservatives as an election volunteer, and he ended up working, as I said before, as sort of a very, very kind of junior aide to an MP in Ottawa. And so it gave the impression that this was somebody who kind of had a very, and he does have a very kind of limited life experience, that is deeply informed by a very rigidly socially conservative Christian family and church and background. And at the same time, he has the same level of devotion to the political party that he represents. What is interesting, though, is the assumption that Sam is not smart is a poor one to make. He's seems to be very, very bright, despite his limited education. For what he has read, he's at least understood. And I mean, you can actually talk to him, for instance, about Plato and Aristotle and some basic sort of political philosophy that he would have taken as a freshman in that first semester at Brock. But what's interesting about the way in which he approaches campaigning also gives you an insight into the way he thinks. His two main competitors when he was running for the party, Rick Dykstra and Tony Quirk, they both operated under a very kind of, let's say, traditional model of campaigning.
Right.
They both had names. They were both well-known in Niagara. Rick Dykstra was well-known. He was the party president, for goodness sake, and a former MP. They functioned, it seemed, on the basis that, listen, I'm a well-known politician. People know who I am. All I need to kind of do is show up and hand out some literature, and I will win by name recognition alone, because municipal politics lives and dies on name recognition. And voter turnouts are traditionally not very high. So if you can get your name out, even if voter turnout is low, you stand a good chance of winning. Sam had an excellent ground game. It was like the ground game that Barack Obama used when he first ran for president, where he and his folk were on the ground, door to door, very aggressive, targeting certain demographics to bring the vote out. In Sam Oosterhoff's case, it was mobilizing his church community and the other church communities in the area that had the same ideology or similar ideology. And so he won, you know, very handily because he did what nobody that was running against him thought he could do, was that this teenager could mobilize hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people out of a church community who would then go out into the larger communities in that riding and drum up further support for him. That has kind of been the key to his political success, is having this religious community very aggressively at his back and campaigning and being his public voice on the ground in his riding.
How has that translated, I guess, both his campaigning style, but also the backing and the close ties to fundamentalist Christianity? How has that translated to his time at Queen's Park?
It's manifested itself in a couple of interesting ways, and it changed when he was a member of opposition to now and some of the things he's been in the headlines for more recently. When he was still an opposition member, there were, for instance, a couple of very key votes that came before the House under the previous Liberal government. One of them was a bill that would finally have eliminated barriers for gay, lesbian, and trans citizens to adopt children. There had been some legislative barriers in this province that had prevented that. I mean, they were sort of deeply discriminatory. The Liberal government had decided to get rid of it. And the bill had all, it was one of those few issues, especially in our hyper-partisan climate, that had all-party support. The Conservatives, then under Patrick Brown, voted with the Liberals to pass the bill. Oosterhoff did not show up for that vote. Shortly thereafter, there was another bill that had come up. It was one of these bills that's more of a statement that because healthcare is more of a federal thing, but it was a bill that protected a woman's right to access abortion services. And again, it was a bill that had support across the aisle. And again, Sam Oosterhoff did not show up. So while he was in opposition, he had this habit of any time that there was a bill to be voted on that was contra to his social conservative views and the social conservative views of his religious base in Niagara West, and it was also an issue that Patrick Brown and the Tories were going to vote for. Because remember, Patrick Brown really did want to move the Conservative Party closer to the center. He did not want it to move further right, kind of where it is now. He was aiming to make it a bit more of a centrist party. Oosterhoff either was told or chose to not show up for the vote. So he never voted against his party, but he made it quite clear that he had no intention of supporting these bills, even when his leader and his party did. And when, you know, I had the opportunity to interview him about this a few times, and he just flat out refused to answer the questions. He would never openly say, I'm not voting on this issue for the following reasons. He would just duck and dodge the question. And if you think about it, he was in a bit of a jam.
Yeah.
Because he was elected to be this socially conservative religious voice by his constituents in Niagara West, but he's expected to toe the party line at the time, which was a little bit more socially progressive than it is now, and he couldn't satisfy both masters. There was no way. If he voted with the party, he would have lost support at home. If he voted against the party, he would have lost support of his leader and his colleagues. So he chose to do nothing by avoiding the vote. Now that the Tories are in power, he's much more bold. If you go back to Christmas last year, he actually put out a Christmas message and as an MPP, as a government MPP, saying, you know, we live in this broken world and effectively the government has to be subservient to the will of God and Jesus, which is a fairly shocking thing for a member of government to
yes.
say. And now, of course, more recently, as you know, he's made it very clear that his intention is to make, in his words, abortion unthinkable in our lifetimes. And all of those messages are rising from his socially conservative religious background.
How big has it been for him to get this kind of platform based on, I guess, his youth and his unique status as one of the few really outspoken social conservatives? Has he just hit on like the right thing at the right time for him anyway?
It's an interesting question. I think that as the province's youngest MPP, as maybe its most openly socially conservative MPP, as somebody who now wears his religious views on his sleeve. I mean, yes, he certainly has an unprecedented platform and soapbox with which to express his views. I'm hard-pressed to think of any other member of the provincial parliament who kind of ticks all those boxes and has the profile that he does. And you know, remember, he's also done other things in the House that have garnered the attention, not just of my newspaper, but the Queen's Park Press. You may remember when the Tories began their attack on the federal carbon tax, he decided on Halloween to sing that version of Monster Mash in the House, where he changed the lyrics to Monster Mash to, you know, we beat the tax.
They did the tax.
They did the carbon tax.
They did the tax.
They wanted all of your cash.
They did the tax.
We wouldn't have any stash.
They did the tax.
They did the carbon tax.
It was extremely corny, but it made headlines. And he's a backbencher. He is an assistant to the Minister of Education.
Yeah, that's why he's so fascinating to me, because he's this outsized presence for a
yes.
really young kid that's managing to, you know, he's the big story today.
It's an outsized presence for a young kid with not just limited political experience, but really limited life experience. He's never really had a career or a straight job. I mean, you know, think about what you were doing when you were 19 or what I was doing when
I
was
rather
19.
Not.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I don't know that either one of us would have necessarily been in a position to be that public at 19. And so it whether this lasts or not, who knows? But at the moment, he's certainly been able to elevate himself, at least in terms of getting press and public attention, that his background and his resume, as it were, you wouldn't expect. If you'd read it, you wouldn't expect he would have the kind of influence and the kind of voice he has at the present moment.
Has he managed to do anything or lead anything in his time as an MPP that has had an actual tangible effect on legislation? I mean, we've talked about a lot of the kind of statements and stunts and that kind of stuff, which certainly have gotten him headlines. Yep. But what kind of policy has he driven, if any?
Only really one. He has been, you know, you can call him a true believer in the religious sense. He's also a true believer in the political sense, in that he was a rabid supporter of Patrick Brown when Patrick Brown was the leader. He had his fall from grace. Doug Ford is now the leader, and he is just as sort of rabidly supportive of this premier as he would have been if Patrick Brown had crossed the finish line and become premier. And he tends to, I'd say, you know, 99% of the time, he just parrots the party line. And by the by, that's got him into some trouble when you do a detailed interview with him, because he's unable to step away from the party speaking points, even to the point of absurdity. For instance, when Doug Ford said, well, we're going to, right after the election, and he decided to slash the number of councillors at the city of Toronto, then he started to announce, well, we're going to get rid of the elections for regional chairs, which had a direct impact here in Niagara. And the talking point was, well, it removes a layer of government, except there was literally no layer of government being removed by canceling this particular elected position. And when I pushed Sam on it, he just kind of gave one nonsensical answer after another, because he was sticking to this script that he had been given, and he couldn't veer off it. And it did kind of reach sort of the theater of the absurd. All of that said, he did lead the charge. It started when he was a backbencher, and it continued through until a bill has actually been before Queen's Park on creating and getting more funding and services for hospices in this province, you know, care for people who are at end of life. And he took that on as a mission almost from the beginning, when he began to run to become the candidate in Niagara West. So that has kind of been his trademark, and you have to give credit where it's due. He has seen it through, all the way through the legislative process. And it was one of those bills that kind of only come out of the backbenches, because it's clearly not an issue that's a front-burning issue for this government. It wasn't a front-burning issue for the last government. This was something that Sam Oosterhoff, you know, through his experience in the hospice in his riding and the other hospice in Niagara, had seen and figured something could be done to improve it. So, I mean, that really, if you're looking for a sort of a signature issue that he's spearheaded, that's the one. Beyond that, though, he essentially has been the good soldier, marching to the tune of this particular administration.
What about his exploits in recent days? Have you been surprised back in St. Catharines by some of the headlines he's been making recently?
We were certainly surprised about the library book thing. So for your listeners who are unfamiliar, the provincial government has slashed library funding, including ending the interlibrary loan program, which is widely used. A group of seniors wanting to protest this got their books together from their library book club, went to Sam Oosterhoff's office, and they were going to stage what they called a read-in,
right,
in which they would sit in his office and read silently. Like, in terms of protests, it's maybe the least disruptive protest I've ever heard of. And when they showed up, his staff called the police,
right,
to have them removed. That in itself is surprising, right? That you would call the police to get rid of, 15 seniors whose greatest offense was going to be to read silently in your office, your public office as the MPP. Sam Oosterhoff was not in the office that day, but then when our reporter reached out later to ask him what went wrong, he defended calling the cops to have these people ejected, first claiming that they had to protect the privacy of other people who were coming into the office to see him. Now, A, he wasn't there, but B, it's a public office, an MPP's office. It's open to the public. Constituents come and go all the time. If you go to your MPP's office, you don't have any expectation that nobody will see you in that office. Then the argument shifted, well, there's confidential information on the computers that we can't allow anybody to see, except nobody was trying to see their computers, and there was no attempt to do so. Then they said, well, you can't have a protest here because we don't actually own the building. They lease it. But most MPPs lease their offices, and the public can show up and protest all they want. And then finally, and this was where it got very strange, he claimed there was a bit of an altercation when they were asked to leave, and that's why the cops were called. Well, we had a reporter and a photographer there for the entire incident, and there was no altercation whatsoever. I think it was 24 or 48 hours after that, he attends the anti-abortion rally in Toronto, in which he says he's going to make abortion unthinkable in our lifetimes. So he's already dealing with a political controversy, and he makes this very dramatic statement, which is maybe the most clear statement he's ever made that arises from that marriage of his politics and his religiosity being married at the same time. And you saw it quite clearly there.
How much of this stuff, and maybe not the library thing, which is ridiculous, but all the other stuff that we've talked about, how much of this do you sense is part of a plan that leads somewhere beyond here for him? Does he have that kind of ambition? And how much of it is just him advocating for what are clearly some pretty deeply held fundamentalist beliefs?
It's hard to know where Oosterhoff's long-term political ambitions lie. But if you know anything about the political ambitions of some segments of fundamentalist Christian culture, there is a real belief that they are on a mission to change society. This is not about running for office to just say, pass some bills or acquire political power for its own sake. And you saw it in the way that anti-abortion rally went. You see it in the way Sam Oosterhoff talks about these messages, talks about how government needs to be subservient to his chosen deity. For people like him, there is this long-term project, which is to reshape society in what they regard as the proper Christian mold. Whether or not Sam can do that over the long term, whether or not he's able to sort of push that Christian agenda into legislation and be part of this transformational project that many fundamentalist, politically active fundamentalist churches are engaged in, we'll have to wait and see.
Thanks for this, Grant.
Oh, my pleasure.
Grant LaFleche, investigative reporter with the St. Catharines Standard. And that was the Big Story Podcast. Just like all the other Big Story Podcasts at thebigstorypodcast.ca, I think you know the title of this show by now. You can find us on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN or at Frequency Pods on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. Most importantly, though, if you like this show, or even if you just have something to say about it, leave us a rating and review
on Apple or Google or Stitcher or Spotify or your favorite podcast application. We read every single one of them, and we take them to heart unless they're mean. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. Thanks for listening. We'll talk tomorrow.